his histories were the most complete and serious attempt to put together a history of the church from Jesus' time. He did it so well and so powerfully that, like most historians, ever after he's been quoted and perpetuated. Most of the time he's right. But there's a lot of modern scholarship. And everyone is recognized, as you will, when I continue with Ignatius, you can't help but admire him, but feel sorry for him. The message of faith in its real essence is already shifted. From Barnabas and Paul, who took those saints that heard the gospel joyously, and Peter's arrival, between those early bishops, which history traces from, which Eusebius traces from Peter to Evosius to Ignatius, the so-called third bishop, leaving out Barnabas and Saul, which in itself, because of the historic tendency to call Peter the first bishop, Evodius next, and then comes Ignatius the third, Paul and Barnabas are left out. Everyone has recognized there's a big difference between the Antioch of the book of Acts and the Antioch that was the battleground where Paul tried to protect the message of grace, and the church that Ignatius was pastor and bishop of. Something intervened. Now, that which intervened, the thesis of this book is Matthew. And though there are many theories of the place of Matthew's composition, this book is maybe the best written yet, and the most convincing, that it was at Antioch that Matthew composed his gospel. It was at Antioch that Matthew resided. It was Matthew, the Jewish tending gospel writer, the one of all the gospels most compatible to the Judaizers, whose influence took over with the departure of Peter at the city of Antioch, which produced the frame of the Antiochian church as you encounter it in Ignatius. And probably history contributed to hiding other facts that are now being dug out. You're going to feel sorry for Ignatius, and yet, in the context of the sacrifice we're teaching, you got to admire him. But his theology was wrong. What he did bordered on suicide. Instead of recognizing that the only thing we get rewarded for, and the only way we increase legal tender to be spent in heaven, is through acts of faith down here, he was already in the bent of works, the supreme work of which is a martyr's crown. He'd have been better off to take the view of Paul. It's better to depart, Paul felt, absent from the body, is present with the Lord. But he was going to finish his course down here. Ignatius shows how quickly, by the turn of the first century, the shift had gone from vital, joyous faith, and having that faith affect time and literally change time by gripping God's word so tight that you will hang on down here defying the circumstance until death, which is then God's choice, takes you. You see him almost the other side of the coin of suicide, wanting his martyr's crown so badly. But having said that qualifier, these New Testament Christians, persecuted throughout those early centuries, had a grip of eternity. You can't question their viewpoint that this world is not our home. The ordinary tender mercies of the rude Roman legionnaire at the best of times were but cruel, and the disagreeable conditions of so trying a journey were not likely to mollify him. Ignatius complains that his guardians were like 10 leopards, so that he was fighting with wild beasts all the way to Rome, by land and sea, by night and day. He complains that they only wax worse when they're kindly treated. I've seen those kind. Haven't you? Yet from this rough treatment, Ignatius says that he was a gainer. It taught him to become more completely a disciple. We do not know with certainty the route which the martyr followed. Probably his escort sailed with him from Seleucia, the port of Antioch, to Attalia in Pamphylia. Thence they made their way overland to Laodicea, and at the bifurcation of the roads near the confluence of the Lycus and the Meander, they chose the northern route which led through Hierapolis, Philadelphia, and Sardis to Smyrna. We know that they took this route because Ignatius alludes to his stay at Philadelphia. He praises the bishop of that city for his gentleness and modesty, but he found that though the church was not divided, its members showed a certain infiltration of evil which they had managed to drain away. His experiences in the city had not been altogether happy. In some way or other, some of the Philadelphian Christians had tried to deceive him in matters of daily life, and he had had a sharp discussion with certain Judaizers. On the other hand, he had enjoyed his intercourse with the church and the friends who afterward joined him, the Cilician deacon Philo and Raus of Agathopus bore witness to the kind hospitality of the Philadelphian community, though they too had reason to complain of some unfriendliness. It is clear from this letter, as from others, that Ignatius, like St. Paul, was indulged with a certain amount of liberty, since all chance of escape was out of question. It must have been no small mitigation of the martyr's trials that he was allowed to discourse with the Christians of every city in which he stayed, which also tells of the spread of Christianity. In this respect also, the circumstances of his journey closely resemble those of Paul the Apostle of the Gentiles. Well, here we go. Join in Sacramento. I'll wait. Let me quit. We've just joined Sacramento. Nice to be in our capital city. We're in the midst of raising our budget for the next year. But I pause to teach on a little church history. And I'm reading from F.W. Farrar's Lives of the Fathers, The Trip of Ignatius, Bishop of Antioch, condemned to die, chained to a Roman legionnaire en route to Rome. In point of fact, from the moment of his condemnation, Ignatius became more and more in the eyes of the Christians a memorable personage whom it was a privilege to see and with whom it was an honor to converse. His counsels were invested with supreme authority, and the highest consideration was everywhere paid to his person. After Philadelphia, we read of no other halt until the little company reached Smyrna. At that city, they stayed some days, perhaps while they were waiting for a vessel to take them on to Alexandria Troas. Now, one of the important things about his letters is he stops at some of the churches named in St. John's Apocalypse, the book of the Revelations. The unfolding. Now, these letters are available. I think we better find these, two of these for the bookstore. But don't put them out until I've finished teaching. Otherwise, you won't read them with the right background of understanding. The role they had in the early church. We'll be talking about how we got our Bible. Now remember, these people in these churches didn't have the King James Version. The letters of Ignatius of Antioch, one to the Ephesians, one to the Magnesians, one to the Trajans, one to the Romans, one to the Philadelphians, one to the Smyrnians, and one to Polycarp, are all translated and contained in this little paperback booklet of the Apostolic Fathers, the various letters and writings that they did. Barnabas, 1st and 2nd Clement, Clement of Rome, who is named by Paul the Didache, perhaps the earliest attempt to systematize New Testament doctrine. The Shepherd of Hermes, or Hermas, Ignatius, and then Polycarp, who at 86 was martyred and asked to blaspheme or to deny his Savior and said, all these years, and he named the years, I've served my Lord and he's done me no harm, how then can I blaspheme the name of the Lord that saved me? These first century heroes, bridging the gap into the second century, are the ones that touch the disciples or their immediate disciples, members of the 70, members of the 12. Now, the Philadelphia halt names no other that we can find until the little company reached Smyrna. The fact of the martyr's condemnation had been made known far and wide. So at Smyrna he was met by deputies from Troas, Magnesia, and Ephesus, through which cities he would have passed if the soldiers had chosen to go by the southern instead of the northern line of route. The churches of these cities had probably been informed of his movements by Christians who met him at Laodicea or at some point near the junction of the roads. Since they lost the advantage of his visit, they at once dispatched deputies to meet him at Smyrna and to report his words. These deputies greatly refreshed his spirit by their communiques and by the proofs which they afforded that the sympathy of the churches of Asia was deeply moved on his behalf. Now, what we're doing is going back to those earliest roots of the five patriarchal sees that took on prominent position in the New Testament world because of their apostolic connections. James, the brother of the Lord, son of Joseph, bishop first at Jerusalem, clubbed to death by some accounts after being cast off the parapet of the Jerusalem wall, and then clubbed to death. Other reports just report the clubbing to death, different from James, the apostle who was beheaded. This James was followed by Simeon, and you can trace Simeon's successors until we reach the age of the church in the 4th century, which is the church of the great councils. The influence of their founders continues to be felt in the churches. There was not a homogeneous church of the New Testament world. Paul and James were at odds in their theology, and it was never resolved. Barnabas and Saul, I've said in the previous half hour, came to be the first pastors and teachers of the Grecian Christians in Antioch. Peter came. James came. That combined Barnabas, Saul or Paul, and Peter, and James at a distance exercising his influence over Peter, gave Antioch its prominent role in the early days of the church and the poverty and subsequent persecutions of the Christians at Jerusalem and the Jewish wars that would break out and the fleeing of the Christians to the city of Pella made the Jerusalem church lose power and influence because of its poverty and the fleeing of the Christians from Jerusalem, but its place in the church remained when a bishop was restored there, and it always was to remain one of the five patriarchal sees until the split off of the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic Church. Antioch quickly moved to prominence. Rome will move to prominence because of the visits of both Paul and Peter, if the traditions are correct, to Rome. Constantinople will have its position because the emperor makes it the new capital of the empire and he makes it the state church, and Constantinople rises to power because of its political influence. Mark will leave Rome and go to Alexandria. and there found the church and ordained the bishops who succeed him at Alexandria. These great churches, Alexandria, Rome, Antioch, Jerusalem, Constantinople, became the power centers that would produce those who would draw their thread of theological roots from whomever was the apostolic force that founded them most strongly. The British church, I keep telling you, was outside of this, developing because God wanted to keep a secret. Now Eusebius of Caesarea, the great church historian, will question Paul's trip to Spain. But Eusebius is in no position to understand the seven times punishment that extends the hiding of the lost tribes of Israel clear into the mid-1800s and the necessity for keeping the role of the British church and the apostolic founder's roles there a secret hid away by God until his set time to reveal these truths. And you will find when I get into this, as well as we did in archaeology, a burst of knowledge that springs forth once we turn the corner of the 1800s and the veil of God's secret is lifted and the punishment time runs and God allows those who search to find the truth. Now, the Antioch church lost the Pauline influence. The thesis of this book that I'll get into places Matthew between the founders and the Apostle Peter and the James influence that took over, and Ignatius. And Ignatius will reflect that trend and will quote Matthew more than any other source because of that bend of the Antiochian church, and its role in the controversies and the councils will continue to be prominent and explain some of the decisions about canonicity or that which is made the straight line of God's revealed word, which is the Greek root of the word canon, and also the words roots in other languages. It means a straight rod, something that measures. The canon is that which is measured out as being the inspired word of God. It wasn't put together in a day, and it wasn't until the 5th century that it really began to gel. And these forces were tugging. James planted his seed, Paul planted his seed of theology, and that tug of war would continue. Then comes the other controversies. We encounter Simon, the magician, in the book of Acts, who wanted to pay to have the power the apostles had when they laid hands on people and began to speak in tongues. Eusebius traces him, and others trace him. He picked up a prostitute in Tyre, took her with him to Rome, got there before Paul got there, and planted the seed because the message of Christ was not being refined in all the realms of the great city of Rome. Simon found an audience there, and he is credited with bringing the first springing forth of Gnosticism. In his trail comes Marcion, going too far in resisting the Judaizing influence and becoming what most call the first really great heretic. All of these streams can only be understood when we go to the roots. Now, Ignatius is going to reflect something that happened between Paul, Barnabas, and Peter. Something in between them and Ignatius changed the shape of Antioch. But let me go on with him. And Matthew seems to be that, but that's another subject. From Magnesia to Smyrna came the bishop Damas, the presbyters Bassus Apollonius, and the deacon Zosian. Now remember, Ignatius is claiming contact with some of the apostles themselves and their disciples. Too cold now. These names become clues, like those who search for sunken treasure in the ocean of history. These are names. Do you have a granddad? reminds me of the evangelist in Washington, D.C., saying to the cab driver, "Do you have a family?" He had his little pet witnessing message. And that big old cab driver looked around and says, "Of course I have a family. What do you think I am?" And what was he said? "I think I sprung forth from the head of a goose." I like that better. Everybody has a family. But how many have your grandfather living? That's what I meant to ask. How many? How many here have a living grandfather? How many grandmother? It's the smaller percentage of us, but there's a few. Well, with Ignatius and these names, we're talking to people whose grandparents would have listened and been of the same generation and general age level as the apostles. We're talking to people from cities who are bishops and leaders in churches whose grandparents, if they were in that church, would have been around to hear the apostles themselves. That's how close we are with Ignatius and these names. From Charles came Bishop Polybius. Ephesus was but 40 miles from Smyrna and had therefore sent more numerous deputies. These were the Bishop Onesimus. That about name ring any bells? A man of great modesty and gentleness for whom Ignatius felt the warmest regard. Euplus. Fronto, of whom nothing special is said. Crocus, he says, a name very dear to me, who probably acted as his secretary when he wrote his letter to the Romans. And Burrus, who made himself so useful that Ignatius begs the Ephesians to spare him, that he might be a friend and companion. You know, it's kind of hard for cold church councils for me to identify with them. If I identify with these people, Christ was a generation and a half. For some of the older, of the same generation. If there were those living around that were 70, 80, 90 years of age, these are people that were eyewitnesses of the first apostolic preaching in their towns. These are names that for the last 4 years I've dug into libraries and searched and kept believing somebody's going to dig up something by some of them, because some of the names have no other reference point in history except their introduction by Ignatius. And some people get bored with those sections. Not me. It's like 2 Timothy 4 and Romans 16. Those names come alive when you understand that most of them are British Christians of the Silurian king's house. And you suddenly, bang, start making the connections with the Senate that he refers to in a way, or the senator that he refers to in a way, as the son of his own mother. Therefore, either half-brother or brother married to the daughter of the Silurian king. And then you find another little entry in history when they give the land to house the ancient church at Glastonbury as a Roman soldier and representative, then, not yet a senator. His name is there in the records in relationship to the hides given that established the land grant for the church at Glastonbury. And you see the connection of this Roman soldier there when this church is granted its space. And the Silurian household, the first Christians of that kingly family that ultimately would make it a Christian nation, and Caradoc, not yet converted, the guerrilla warrior that resisted the Romans and was never defeated, who gave the speech that Tacitus records in his histories, the Roman historian, is so moved, the Roman Senate, that the Emperor Claudius wouldn't take his life but gave him house parole, and that's the household of the Gentile church. These names suddenly come alive. There'll be more and more of them as archaeology continues to dig, will be made to come alive from these brief references. Burrus, who made himself so useful that Ignatius begs the Ephesians to spare him that he might be a friend and companion. Just as St. Paul would fain have begged Philemon to spare to him the services of Onesimus. In all the four letters which Ignatius wrote from Smyrna, he wrote four from there, he speaks with grateful affection of these Ephesian deputies, and we're glad to learn the flourishing condition of a church to which, among others, St. Paul had written the most beautiful of his letters, the Epistle to the Ephesians. The church of Smyrna was not behindhand in consoling the sorrows of its illustrious guest. Many names are mentioned as I skip along. Above all, Polycarp, the bishop of Smyrna, who was himself destined to play so heroic a part on the stage of martyrdom 45 years later. A letter by him is in this book. The widows took their share in lightening the sufferings of the doomed victim. We do not know how long Ignatius and his 10 leopards, as he called them, and the little band of friends and fellow captives who probably accompanied him, halted at Smyrna. Maybe only a few days. But these few days were of the utmost value to the history of the church. They gave Ignatius the leisure and opportunity to write four letters which throw one flash of light on years which otherwise would be lost in oblivion. The letters were very brief. Probably the longest of them, that to the Ephesians, could without difficulty have been written in a day. They're also of the simplest character. In themselves, so far as any profound or original thought is concerned, they'd be nearly valueless. They derive their importance almost exclusively from the insight which they give us into the thoughts of an early Christian martyr 18 centuries ago, and from the indications which they furnish of the condition of the Christian churches at a period for which we're left almost destitute of other documents. These four letters from Smyrna were written to the four churches of Ephesus, Magnesia, Troas, and Rome. In his letter to the Ephesians, he first speaks writing to the Magnesians, writing to the Christians of Troas, he warns them. And the fourth letter, written to the Romans, is of a different character. It's the only one that's dated. In his letter to Troas, he had alluded to his coming martyrdom, to his dread of being seduced by flattery into spiritual pride, to his doubts whether he is really worthy to suffer for Christ, and to his desire for the grace of gentleness whereby the prince of this world is brought to naught. But the letter to the Romans is occupied almost exclusively with this topic of his coming martyrdom, and is full of energetic originality and a sort of somber fire. Certain Syrians had preceded Ignatius at Rome. They were probably delegates from the Church of Antioch who had been sent to Italy by sea immediately after his condemnation to announce his fate and his speedy arrival. Ignatius is afraid that when the Roman Christians receive the news, the more influential among them will exert themselves to procure a remission of his punishment, a subtle hint of the power of that Roman church in influence of the emperor, because that Roman church, the Gentile portion of it, was the one whose daughter received the adoptive name of Claudius from the Roman emperor and had special connections and positions of power with the Roman authorities. Ignatius, afraid that when the Roman Christians receive the news, the more influential among them will exert themselves to procure remission of his punishment, especially the preservation of his life. He passionately implores them not to do so. Surely they would not rob him of his great opportunity. You don't want me to finish. Yeah, here is that letter to the Romans. Ignatius, also called Theophorus, to her who has obtained mercy by the greatness of the Father Most High and of Jesus Christ, his only Son, to the church beloved and enlightened by the will of him who willed all things that exist, in accordance with the love of Jesus Christ our God, the church which presides in the place of the country of the Romans, worthy of God, worthy of honor, worthy of blessing, worthy of praise, worthy of success, worthy of sanctification and preeminent in love, named after Christ, named after the Father, which I salute in the name of Jesus Christ. I am writing to all the churches, and I command all men. I am voluntarily dying for God if you do not hinder me. I exhort you not to be an inopportune favor to me. Let me be food for the wild beasts, through which I can attain to God. I am the wheat of God, and I am ground by the teeth of wild beasts, so that I may be found the pure bread of Christ. Instead, entice the wild beasts, so that they may become my tomb and leave no trace of my body, so that when I fall asleep, I may not burden anyone. Then I shall be truly a disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, what happened? I mean, this is just three bishops away from Paul. What happened? That this honest, sincere man thought that that throwing himself at martyrdom. Oh, I've heard all the preaching. I think it's wonderful. I think the martyrs singing praises to God did more to break the back of the Roman Empire than all the theologians and all the preaching. But there's a difference between the martyrs who had no choice, and when the moment of offering came, would lift their head high and let the world know what Paul would say later, that death was a beginning, not an end. There is a big difference between that heroic statement when you are forced to be a martyr, as Polycarp was, and this that borders on suicide, and set an example that made the church have to react ultimately and teach against that over-eager seeking of martyrdom. What was it that changed the shape of the church until Origen? Another one I haven't gotten to yet. Would castrate himself, thereby mutilating his body, to remove temptation. Now you find a hint of that in Paul's writings of those that have mutilated themselves. He isn't recommending it. He's referenced that some have done it. What is it that changed this glorious, abundant life message of faith that turned the world upside down quickly and spread the gospel through the world? To a bend and a caricature to where sincere people were offering their works. This is just an offering of works. I don't care how you slice it. This is an offering of works. I've read all the books that make him a great hero, and I remember when I was ordained, the required reading was Fox's Book of Martyrs, without distinguishing between those that brought it on themselves and those that became a glorious testimony when God's will brought them to the point of the heroes of Hebrews 11, of whom the world was not worthy. What is it? I'm going to tell you in a sentence and not dangle it. that unsettled war of the church that's still going on. Faith versus works. And I'm not talking about antinomianism either, which is another jaw-breaking word we'll come to. Don't let anyone ever dare suggest that James Scott preaches the grace of God and the faith of God as though there is no importance to the kind of life change that occurs in a Christian. But what the church got off the track on was the means of salvation. The trigger that must be pulled that enables God to do the work of saving us. You act in faith, God's going to change you. Your behavior will take on His quality because it's God being Himself through you. And the knowledge of the difference between godliness and ungodliness lays in front of you the measuring rod for your own self-analysis that drives you then to the means of change, which is more acts of faith that brings God's presence alive in you to do the changing. But somewhere they got off that track, and it became their effort of saving themselves and obtaining eternal rewards through their works. What caused the change? And this was by the first century. If Satan can't keep you from God, he'll caricature the relationship. That's why it's so important. And here we are in the 20th century and the battle's still not been resolved. 15 centuries go by and Luther starts to deliver the people again from the end result of a religion of works to the selling of indulgences. You better keep this ministry alive, don't you think?